Indeed, my guest is Dr. Doug Beeson, Associate Laboratory Director of Los Alamos National Labs, responsible for programs tasked with eliminating the global threat of weapons of mass destruction. This guest, within hours of what now appears almost surely to have been a nuclear test by North Korea, something the world has been fearing for some time now. And I'm going to ask the audience to be, if you can be, please, as sensitive as possible to the position Dr. Beeson is in right now. And I think by now, if you've been listening, you all understand what that position is. I've got a couple of additional questions for Dr. Beeson, and then we're going to go to the phones when we come back. Once again, Dr. Doug Beeson. Dr. Beeson, a couple of sort of follow-up questions here. With respect to lasers, is it true or not that current technology depends upon pulsing the laser to get the kind of effect you're talking about, taking something out, for example, in the boost phase at 30 or 40,000 feet? Are you using a pulsed laser to do that?
I guess the best way to answer that is yes, that's technically correct, but no in the sense of that the pulses occur so quickly together that for all practical purposes, nothing can tell that it's pulsed, that it thinks that it's continuous wave. That is, when the pulses occur within sub-millionths of a second together, that is, the material itself that the pulse interacts with thinks that it's a continuous pulse. Now, there are several types of what we call continuous wave lasers that are also being used or projected to use. For example, deuterium fluoride is a type of laser that has been used by the U.S. Army at White Sands Missile Range to successfully shoot down Katusha rockets. In fact, over 30 Katusha rockets, the same type that were launched against Israel just several months ago. If you remember those attacks against Israel, I think everybody does. The Katusha rockets were brought down about 4 years ago in the White Sands by a deuterium fluoride laser, which was a continuous wave or continuous type of laser. The airborne laser uses a coil or chemical oxygen iodine laser, which is a type of also a CW laser or continuous wave laser. And so when you talk about power level, some people say, well, you can have high powers by having these very short pulses, and it's not really very much energy. And that is true to an extent. But what is important in the damage mechanism, that is being able to kill ballistic missiles or Katusha rockets or whatever, is the amount of energy that you actually put on a target.
Now, the amount of energy, that brings up my next question. In early science fiction, with regard to lasers, even those that might be space-based, nuclear power was going to be required to actually power the lasers sufficiently. Is that still true?
Well, some of the lasers that the old Strategic Defense Initiative, the so-called Star Wars program, wanted to use, some of those concepts did use nuclear explosions to drive lasers. In fact, Dr. Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb, had proposed using a laser powered by nuclear explosions called Excalibur, put nuclear explosions in space to power these lasers as anti-ballistic missile lasers. However, nowadays, we have enough energy via chemical means, be it coil-type lasers or deuterium fluoride, to achieve nearly the same amount of power level. But in the future, what we're going to see are even more efficient ways of producing lasers, and that is with electric lasers, things such as the free electron lasers, by actually accelerating beams of electrons to produce laser light is extremely efficient. And if we're going to have the powerful lasers needed for long-distance strategic-type applications, I think it's really going to be something like electric lasers, like free electron lasers, that are going to be used instead of the chemical lasers, which we use nowadays.
Okay. on the surface of it, this might seem like a dumb question, but the more I thought about it, it's not so dumb. Steve in Texas says, couldn't you put mirrors all over the missile and then the laser would be useless? Well, obviously, mirrors wouldn't survive a launch, but a highly reflective surface of a missile might have roughly the same effect. Would that be a deterrent?
Yeah, actually, Steve has a great question. That was one of the very first criticisms that were brought up of using lasers for anti-ballistic missile purposes. Yes, lasers are reflected by mirror surfaces. But on the other hand, one of the big problems in building these huge strategic lasers is to be able to direct the laser beam itself. That is, you have to use mirrored surfaces, which are so highly refined that that you want to keep away from absorbing any part of the beam itself.
That's right.
As a result, that's because you would destroy the laser itself. Mm-hmm. As a result, much effort's been given in producing mirrors that are of extremely high quality that can focus these beams. Now, if you were to try to put the same caliber or same quality of laser on a rocket body, you would weigh the rocket body down so much that it wouldn't be able to launch. And plus, you are absolutely right, Art, is that it would lose its quality as it was going through the atmosphere. But simply polishing a rocket body or trying to put a mirrored surface on it just wouldn't work, because even if you were to be able to reflect 99.9% of all laser radiation, you'd still absorb that 0.1%, and that would still be enough to harm you. And so that was a great question, great criticism, and the U.S. military went through a very long testing process to show that that is not a viable defense.
All right, and since you talked about microwaves, a subject that we've talked about a lot here on Coast to Coast, and we've had a number of experts here on it, as you know, we all know, we're in an energy shortage situation, peak oil, maybe. Certainly, prices are going up through the roof, and we need energy. Now, one perhaps viable concept has been to have a satellite in space collecting solar energy at a very, very efficient percentage, and then microwaving it back to Earth. What do you think about that that idea?
Well, I think that that you might have read one of my fiction books, and you're setting me up as a straight man, because I had a book out called Ill Wind that I wrote with a friend of mine, Kevin Anderson. He's written some of the Dune books. Mm-hmm. In fact, this book was just optioned by ABC as a miniseries. And part of the premise of this book is that to help with some of the energy crisis that is ongoing, that a series of satellites had been lofted into space and converts solar energy into microwave energy and beams it down to Earth. We did that for a very specific purpose in the book, to get around some of the energy crisis that we're developing in the fictional account that Kevin and I wrote about. But in practicality, studies have shown that it's not only possible, but this might be the preferable way to help solve some of the energy crisis. The reason is that just by putting out solar arrays on Earth, that is not enough. There's not enough space on Earth to be able to gather enough solar energy power for our electrical needs, that you have to be more efficient to do so. And a more efficient way is to collect that in space, where you can have larger areas, convert it to something like microwaves and beam it to Earth. Of course, there are always problems that people talk about. What about birds flying through the beam or airplanes? Mm-hmm. Well, as it turns out, the energy that you're beaming down, you can do so at energy densities of less than 1/10 of what sunlight is. But yet, because of the frequency of radiation and the conversion efficiencies, you can actually pull back energy in a very, very efficient way. And so, yes, it's possible. It's an extremely expensive way to try to do that. I like it because it's high tech, but it doesn't mean that it's actually the best way to help solve the energy crisis.
Okay. All right. We're going to go to the phones. I have no idea what you're about to meet up with, and so here we go. first-time caller line. You're on the air with Dr. Doug Beeson. Hi.
Hi, Art. I want to commend you for this terrific program.
Thank you.
I want to commend Dr. Beeson. I'm a retired social scientist from the University of Wisconsin, and I just think he is terribly clear and very, very tactful in what he's telling us.
I want to commend him for even showing up.
One question, though, I did want to ask you, and it's from my background in Air Force intelligence during the Korean War, which means I'm an old soldier. I recall that, pardon?
We didn't say anything.
Okay, you're hearing me good. I've followed intelligence work for 50 years. And my recollection is that Francis Gary Powers in the U-2 was shot down at 50,000 feet. Can you talk somewhat about the ability to maneuver away from anti-aircraft fire like the Russians shot at Powers? Well, the thing that you said earlier, which touched me off on this, was that you had to get these rockets when they were in their forthcoming stage, and you had to be about 100 kilometers away. It seems to me the big 747 would be extremely vulnerable to rocket fire like the Russians brought Powers
down. Right. Yeah, that's a very good question, Doctor.
Yeah, that's a great question. In fact, that was one of the early criticisms of the airborne laser is how do you protect it against, first of all, how do you get it close enough so that you can make sure the laser energy that you're putting on target is energetic enough, but yet how do you move it away far enough to be able to detect the aircraft? Well, as it turns out, the concept of operations, that is the CONOPS that Air Combat Command has right now, is just like it has with any other what they call high-value target. That is, there are several very slow-moving yet very valuable assets that the U.S. military uses, such as the Airborne Warning and Control System, AWACS, or even fuel tankers that need to be brought up close to the adversary's borders. But you don't want to bring them so close that they're close enough for surface-to-air missiles. That's the biggest threat. And the second threat is other enemy aircraft. And so what you typically do is that you, you provide it with CAP or close air patrols, that is aircraft, fighter aircraft, that surround it to keep it safe from enemy aircraft. And also you keep it far enough away from the enemy border so that the surface-to-air missiles can't reach it. And so that type of technique is already used for other type of aircraft, and it's envisioned that that type of technique will be used to protect the airborne laser. But in addition, something else that is nice about the airborne laser is that because it can defend against rockets that are ballistic missiles that are punching through the cloud barrier, you can also use the same sensors on board and also the laser on board to protect itself against any surface-to-air missiles. So not only do you have the concept of operations that helps, that is, you keep it away from the borders, you have the fighter aircraft protecting you, but also you use the laser itself on board as a self-protection mechanism. Great question.
Okay. Here's another question out of left field, Doctor. I interview frequently Dr. Michio Kaku, who's one of our nation's premier theoretical physicists, and when you really pin that man down, he's not exactly what you would call pro-nuclear in any way at all. But when you really pin him down, he describes several levels that mankind will likely go through. In other words, we're a type zero planet right now, and we're on the verge of becoming a type one planet, which would then control more energy in type two and type three on down the line long after we're dead. But we're in this strange little transitional phase right now between type zero and type one. And when you really, really pin him down about what he thinks our chances are of surviving the discovery of element 92, it's It's really extremely depressing. In other words, with proliferation going the way it has been going, and today we have a great example, he just doesn't think that that we will, as a species, survive. What do you think?
Well, I think that I'm more optimistic than that. every generation has its own set of problems. There are some that are more dangerous than others. But, well, for example, I was... when I arrived in Washington, D.C. yesterday, I had a little bit of time. I went over the National Archives, and one of the things I discovered was that back in the 1700s, George Washington had actually discovered that the British were using smallpox as a biological weapon. That is, that they were affecting people and sending them out to infiltrate the American colonies as a weapon against the U.S., and there's been some coincidence measurements and data that have come out that this is one of the first uses of a widespread bioterrorism. And so we will always have, no matter what age we're in, the threat of the generation. I think that plutonium is a threat of our generation. It's one that with the correct technological investments and the political will, I think that that we can mount a an effective campaign. But I just don't. I guess I'm more optimistic in the resilience of the human spirit to be able to rise up against something like this. And
it's just not one of the better days in that campaign today.
Well, that's right. Today's particularly bad. But I've always been optimistic.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with an optimistic Dr. Beeson. Hello.
Hello. Congratulations, first of all, there, Art. And
thank you.
I wanted to bring up the point that it was reported some time back, I think it was around 10 years, that none other than Donald Rumsfeld was involved in giving North Korea plutonium.
And, okay. That's a pretty good question. Doctor, do you know whether we have... I can't imagine that... we would have delivered plutonium to North Korea, but
I'm not aware of that.
Wouldn't seem like the first thing we'd be doing, or ever do.
There might have been some help that the U.S. I know gave to North Korea about trying to incentivize it to use whatever processing it had been doing to for purposes of civilian nuclear energy, but I don't know. I haven't heard that. I can't speak on that.
Right. What kind of actual hopes do you have, Dr. Beeson, that we can succeed with non-proliferation? It's a bad day to be asking that, but what do you think?
Well, I think part of the message here is that simply treaties and things like that can't prevent proliferation. We've seen, again, I'm speaking as a private citizen and not
yes.
with my Los Alamos hat on, but from what I've seen, especially 10 years ago with the Pakistan and India nuclear test, where they circumvented the world proliferation constraints, we've seen now, if this is indeed a nuclear test, we've seen now North Korea, and there are other countries out there that that people worry about as well. And so I think that's something that the nations have to step up to a more aggressive role in rather than just relying on pure policy to prevent the proliferation of these type of weapons.
Do you think,
again, as a private citizen.
Yes, of course. Do you think that today's news will reshape the kind of attitude you just talked about?
Well, I think it's going to depend upon what happens after this, actually.
That's a good point. All right, Dr. Doug Beeson is my guest. He's exactly the right guy at the wrong time. He's Associate Laboratory Director of Los Alamos National Labs, responsible for programs tasked with eliminating the global threat of weapons of mass destruction. Today's news in that category is extremely worrisome. It's always difficult to cover any kind of breaking news, but that's what we're doing this night. From Manila, I'm Art Bell. Indeed, here I am. My guest is Dr. Doug Beeson. Good day, everybody. Stan has an interesting question from Los Angeles, and we'll give Dr. Beeson a moment to think about that or decide he won't answer it. And that is, where did North Korea get the material they've used for these bombs? Now, we know they got it from a reactor they have there, but the question really from Stan is whether they have the natural reserves of it in their own country or whether they got it all from someplace else. It's a pretty interesting question. We'll be right back with it. All right, Dr. Stan in Los Angeles has, I think, kind of an interesting question. Does North Korea have natural reserves of uranium to mine to be doing all this, or did they get it somewhere else?
Well, I'm sure that they got it somewhere else. I don't know where. But that was part of the deal, I think, that was struck about 10 years ago in trying to help them with their nuclear capability for peaceful purposes. And if you remember in 2003, then when the U.S. Confronted North Korea about violating the intent of of carrying out a peaceful nuclear program for energy purposes, they pulled in 2003, the North Koreans pulled out of the Nonproliferation International Treaty and refused anybody else, of course, to come and look at their facilities. That's when, of course, the escalation began publicly. But of course, it had to begin years before then, because you just can't generate that much nuclear material of the right quality and quantity to conduct a test with a span of just a few years.
Indeed. Okay, let's go to a wild card line and Bill in Arizona. Bill, you're on the air with Dr. Doug Beeson.
Hello, Doctor. Hello, Art.
Hi.
First of all, congratulations, Art.
Thank you.
And my first question is, however unlikely, what is the chances that they may have set off some explosion? I mean, big enough? You know, is there any possible way it would have been big enough to maybe give the intentions that they're actually, you know, have the nuclear power?
Or put another way, you're asking, could they have faked it?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great question. In fact, from the news reports, the unclassified news reports coming out, that it was around 500 tons of explosion or something, a seismic event. Typically, when a nuclear explosion occurs, about 50% of a nuclear weapon's yield or explosive power goes to radiative type effects, and the other 50% goes to blast type effects. And that's the type of and what we mean by blast effects, that's typically what couples into the ground to create the seismic effect. And so when you say that was it a nuclear test or was it a high explosive conventional test, if it was high explosive conventional, then you can multiply that number of about 500 tons by a factor of 2. And so you get about 1,000 tons, which is about a kiloton of equivalent high explosive energy that would have been needed to create the same type of effect that we would have seen seismically.
Seismically, yeah.
That's right.
I see.
So it's possible, but also there are other characteristics that are different. One characteristic is that the high explosive test lasts much longer. Nuclear tests are over very quickly. I can't get into the right, you know, exact time scales, but happened on the order of millisecond, where a millisecond is a thousandth of a second. Conventional high explosive tests, like we see in TNT or C4 or whatever, last over many, many tens of milliseconds. So there's a time difference that you'll also see. And since they haven't said anything about the time differences, I'm sure that's part of the data that they're analyzing right now.
Would it be your view, Doctor, without telling me, again, anything at all classified, that at the highest levels, we already know if this was a nuclear test or not?
I'm sure the president's been given
the assessment of the intelligence communities, and that position has been fully vetted among the different agencies that advise the president.
So all that's already happened.
I'm and it's ongoing, I'm sure, with as we gain additional data as well.
Would you even want to hazard a guess about when the intelligence community will, through our political leadership, announce that in fact it was a nuclear test or not?
No, I just don't. I just can't imagine when, and it's not because I don't. It's mostly because I don't know.
Okay, let's go west of the Rockies to Lynn in Washington.
Hello, I'm calling from an island near Seattle, so I guess I must be calling in from Ground Zero tonight, according to the news. I always get so plugged in by this conversation. It really gets me mad because it seems so hypocritical when we talk, we do all this hand-wringing about other countries having a nuclear weapon, because here we sit armed to the eyeballs with nukes pointed in every which way. And yet earlier tonight, the guest was real, there was a lot of concern about if North Korea could reach the West Coast. Well, how many places can we reach?
We can reach them all, dear. You're absolutely right about that. But there is a qualitative difference.
Please point it out.
In North Korea and the United States, or even India and Pakistan. North Korea, obviously, we all know, is a very different kind of situation, and surely you understand that.
No, I disagree.
You do?
Because
okay.
Historically, we're the only country on Earth that has split the atom
ever,
and used it against
right.
the civilian population, not once but twice. That mm-hmm. would make us historically the most dangerous population on the Earth, wouldn't
okay.
it?
Well, all right. Doctor, respond to that.
I'm here to be interviewed about a book on the E-bomb.
That's true. All right, don't respond to it. That's fine. Hey, by the way, let's go ahead and plug you're absolutely right. I mean, that's what you were here for. And so your book is available at a very reasonable price right now, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In fact, Amazon.com or even through my own website, DougBeeson.com, you can learn about not only how to obtain the book, but also more about directed energy. I try to give you not only information about that, but to also get you to other sites that talk about lasers, high-power microwaves, mm-hmm. Some of the advances. In fact, there are even some educational websites that are out there. There's the Center for Directed Energy in Dayton, Ohio, for example, that is involved with looking at the effects of directed energy weapons.
And again, it's called the E-bomb, how America's new directed energy weapons will change the way wars will be fought in the future. And I guess the way it's going right now, we better hope the very near future. Let's see. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Beeson. Hello.
Chris from Columbus, Ohio.
Yes, Chris.
New energy weapons. I've understood for years that we have a bomb called the neutron bomb, known as the real estate weapon. Neutron explodes at the speed of light, hits a human being, explodes, and leaves the real estate intact. Nobody ever talks about this weapon. As I understand it, we have it. This is the perfect weapon for a situation like Korea or anyone else. Also, my observation is what we do here with Korea will also tell what Iran's going to do next. But could you talk a little bit about the neutron bomb and how it works, and maybe you have a little information on that?
Sure. We can ask anyway, Dr. Beeson, the neutron bomb.
Well, I know that about 15 years ago, it was publicized that the possibility of producing one of those was possible. Mm-hmm. I can't really talk about what's in our inventory now, but I don't think that any more work had really been carried out on that because of different high-level policy decisions. But neutron bombs are really not directed energy, because they don't direct any of the neutrons, which are elementary particles, in any direction. They go in all directions. And, in fact, the type of directed energy weapons, when people talk about DEW, or directed energy weapons, include really just lasers and microwaves, high-power microwaves. About 10 years ago, particle beam weapons, which consist of either electron beams or neutral particle beams or charged particle beams, were being considered
as part of directed energy. And this is the difference here is that those are actual beams of matter versus, say, lasers or high-power microwaves, which are just various parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. Particle beams actually use elementary matter, be it electrons or ions, to accelerate those to use as weapons, kind of like lightning weapons, if you could harness weapons, but in a very directed, very lethal way. The problem with that is that we know the lightning is very destructive, but it's almost impossible to harness that energy because you can't make it go where you want to go. It takes the successful tests that they've been able to field that demonstrate that it is possible to propagate particle beam weapons, use buildings the size of aircraft carriers to produce the power to produce the right environment to do it. And it's just not practical to weaponize anything like that. And so the result is that type of work has kind of fallen off. They've concentrated just on lasers and microwaves, and no type of either neutron or other particle-type weapons are really being looked at right now.
I wonder why. I mean, the neutron bomb, the rough assessment or description of the neutron bomb was that it explodes. It doesn't destroy any real estate. It just kills all the people. And if it's not in our inventory, I mean, why not? Well, I wonder what the rationale for not putting it in our inventory would possibly be, because horrible as it is to kill people, it seems to me that not destroying the real estate and making it unlivable for the rest of forever would be a big advantage over a giant explosion making everything unlivable for generations.
Well, you still have an explosion with a neutron bomb because you need to be able to generate it. It's just that was a policy decision that was made at the highest level of our government many years ago, over a decade ago. And as a scientist, I really can't, especially as a scientist that's supporting the government now, I really can't go against, you know, policy-type decisions.
Of course not. All right, let's go. I'm looking at the times here. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on the air with Dr. Beeson. Hi.
Hi. A couple quick questions. Does it raise any eyebrows as far as Japan being able to develop a nuclear bomb with the armistice signed at the end of World War II? I would think that would be a definite, you know, no way. And, you know, they were just pointing their bayonets at everybody in the region back 63 years ago. So while the Korean situation is urgent, you know, if Iran develops the Shahed missile, will Germany be able to develop nuclear weapons?
Yeah, well, that's the whole proliferation question, excuse me. I don't know. If I were Japanese right now, I would be thinking very heavily, I guess, about protecting myself. Now, if you were to put yourself, doctor, in the place of the Japanese right now, and you had the raw materials to do it, and we certainly know the Japanese have the expertise to do it, would you be, if you were an advisor to the Japanese government, would you be advising them to be putting together nuclear weapons, or would you be advising them in some other way?
Well, I know that the Japanese are not prohibited by any external armistice, if the term was used earlier on that. It's mostly a part of their constitution about how they have their own defense force.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they have all the options that are open to them as a sovereign nation, and it would really depend upon the path that they decide to go forward on. I guess I'll just step back on that.
Okay.
I do know that they are very interested in using nuclear power for civilian peaceful purposes. The whole global nuclear energy program, a project that the current administration is pushing, is one that has been realized worldwide, that to get away from the disastrous environmental effects of having coal or oil burning nations, to get away from that and to go to something which is much cleaner and much safer, that you're going to have to embrace more nuclear energy. And I know that the Japanese are very interested in that, are really leaders in the world right now in developing very efficient, highly safe type of nuclear reactors, along with several other countries. And here they are in a situation where they may feel threatened, but again, like any nation, they have a variety of options that are open to them.
Mm-hmm. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Beeson. Hello.
Hello, thank you for taking my call, and congratulations, too.
Thank you.
I got one quick comment and one quick question. I know time is short. First, to answer your question about the Japanese ships, I've been watching the news, and there are no Japanese or U.S. military assets moving towards North Korea.
I appreciate the update. Thank you.
And the question is, are you a doctor? Is your research, Los Alamos experimenting to put directed energy weapons on submarines or warships at this time? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the question. Great question. As it turns out, the United States Navy is very interested in developing what is known as a free electron laser, an FEL, free electron laser. And the way that that works, it's an electric laser where a electron beam, a form of elementary particle, is accelerated past a series of magnets called a wiggler. And they're called a wiggler because the magnetic fields cause the electron beams to wiggle. And if the conditions are right, that is the right energy level of the electrons and the right spacing of the magnets, what comes out of the electrons as they wiggle past these fields is a very coherent light that is in phase with each other, and that's exactly what a laser is. It's coherent light that's in phase with each other. What that means is suppose that you have a electromagnetic field where all the wave fronts are exactly matched. It's kind of like having soldiers that are all stepping right in line, all pointing in the right direction. That's all a laser is. And this free electron laser can generate this laser field very efficiently, that is, with a very low loss of power, and it can produce high levels of power, that is, in the megawatt or millions of watt class. Well, the Navy wants to develop a laser such as this to put on its new electric ship, and the reason is to use it for defensive purposes against the high G cruise missiles that are coming online right now that might be used against Navy vessels. This is a program that will probably take 5 to 10 years to come to fruition. They're very interested in this, and the reason, again, they want to go to free electron lasers is not only because of the high power and the high efficiency, but you can tune the wavelength of this laser. Typical wavelengths that you have on lasers are in the infrared, that is the heat, or they're in the visible, but they all have problems because they either scatter or they're absorbed by the atmosphere. These free electron lasers, though, you can tune them so that the frequency can be optimized to just slip right through the atmosphere.
Wow.
So that it's not absorbed by the water vapor, not scattered that much. And if the Navy is successful, then it could put a very accurate, very highly precise weapon on one of its electric ships sometime in the future.
All right, Dr. Beeson, our time is up. I want to thank you for being here. It was indeed a brave act for you to even continue to agree to be on the program under these circumstances. Dr. Beeson, under other circumstances, I want to have you back, and we'll do a show that, just like a laser beam, focuses on what you're doing or writing about, I guess I ought to say. Buddy, thank you for being here.
That's great. And if people would pick up a copy of the E-bomb, I'd really appreciate that.
That indeed so. Doctor, good night.
Thank you. Good night.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. As I said, doing a program under these extreme circumstances is pretty wild in the first place, but we got it done. For this weekend, that's it. I'm Art Bell at Mindspring.com from Southeast Asia. Good night.